Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Friday, December 22nd. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
All right, and from the front pages of the Quad City Times, Christmas Kicks for Kids. Coal Valley Man Gathers Shoes for East Moline Children. This written by Tom Lowy, who is a reporter with the Quad City Times. A crazy idea started to grow in Brent Hammerlink's mind as the holidays drew near. It nagged at the 42-year-old Coal Valley resident as his thoughts turned to the year past and the things he learned from children. He thought about the needs of kids who don't have all the basics. Hammerlink remembered the times his family struggled when he was growing up, and he thought about his love for shoes. The idea became Christmas Kicks for Kids, an effort Hammerlink started just weeks ago. The goal is simple. Get as many new and gently used sneakers as possible for the kids. He determined to start with kids in the East Moline School District. Sitting inside the living room of his home just up the road from Niobe Zoo, Hammerlink explained the origins of his idea. Back in January of this year, I had shoulder surgery and I was off work for a bit, he said. He has owned and operated Hammerlink Construction since 2016. Kayla, my wife, was working at Wells Elementary School at the time, and they needed volunteers to come in and spend time with the kids during their lunch periods. Hammerlink started coaching his sons, Ethan and Carter, when they were young, and he enjoyed spending times working with kids. He jumped at the chance. Some kids don't have dads. For some kids, dads might not be in the home or has a job that limits the time he has with his kids, Hammerlink said. I could tell that a number of the kids really wanted that interaction because kids started asking to spend time with me. Hammerlink learned some things while he volunteered. You hear about poverty. We all do, he said. But I started seeing it right there, up close. The stories some of those kids told me were really hard to hear. Some of those stories broke my heart. Hammerlink saw children lacking some of the basics, like shoes. I went to Orion Schools, and my parents always provided for us, but there were tough times. And even at Orion, shoes were kind of a status symbol or maybe a self-esteem thing for kids, he said. And then I go to Wells and I see kids who barely have anything. The kids he met at Wells stayed on Hammerlink's mind for a long time. A few weeks ago, he started talking to his wife about a crazy idea. I started talking about getting shoes for the kids at Wells, and I thought maybe it was unrealistic, crazy, he said. And Kayla said, just do it. Go for it. And I really liked that. So here I am. I'm collecting money and shoes for the kids at Wells and the kids from schools in the East Moline District. Hammerlink said, and his family got it, 15 pair of shoes donated and raised another $900 from other family members and friends. The goal is to collect and buy through Christmas, then take the shoes to kids in January when they go back to school, Hammerlink said. I'm going to make this an official charity and I'm really going to go for it. Hammerlink said some of his desire to help kids feel good about their shoes is deeply personal. I grew up with Michael Jordan as my idol. I love all the Chicago sports teams, and I always wanted Jordans, Air Jordans. As an adult, I got a pair here and there. But I drank. I would go to the bar after work or pick up my alcohol on the way home. And on January 15th, here coming up, I'll be 6 years sober. So now I buy myself some Jordans and I think about all the things I'm thankful for and why I don't drink anymore. Hammerlink also wants to share a feeling. I want my kids to want to help others, to understand what an honor it is to be able to give, he said. And I want the kids out there to know someone cares. I want them to have something to feel good about. And maybe they'll grow up and be able to help others one day. I just hope this is a start of something. Hammerlink has started the Facebook page Christmas Kicks for Kids to provide updates. Donations to the effort can be done on Cash App at Brent-Hammerlink.
The next article on the front page is titled Calls for Resignation. This is by Olivia Allen and Gretchen Teske. The president of the staff union at Black Hawk Area Special Education District is calling for the resignation of that organization's two administrators. The two in question, the Black Hawk Area Special Education District Director, Kristen Schrader, and Center Principal Amy Skinner, are being accused of creating, quote, a hostile work environment, unsafe for students and staff, and practice unfair treatment of staff, end quote, the staff union president, Mark Buick, said in a submission to the Quad City Times on Wednesday. However, at least one member of the union said he is not speaking for the entire union in making these demands. Buck, a teacher at the organization's Phoenix program in Carbon Cliff, said these demands hail from several alleged incidents, specifying one involving Skinner prior to her employment with the group, and claims of retaliatory behavior. In 2019, Skinner had her Iowa teaching license temporarily suspended following an incident where she blew a breathalyzer result of 0.192 while on the job in the 2017-18 school year. Upon completing the required corrective steps per the Iowa Board of Educational Examiners, her license was reinstated roughly a year later. Skinner had no previous history of discipline regarding her teaching license. Prior to this, Buick said the union was already, quote, going after her for creating a hostile work environment, end quote. He made similar claims of Schrader, who he alleges recently called a paraeducator into her office after the employee was arrested outside of school hours. The union has not disclosed the employee's name as they are trying to help them keep their job. In this meeting, Buick said the employee was alone, without union representation. He said she's ignoring all these school codes, labor laws, and workers' rights. The big thing is our students deserve better. It's not safe for them or staff to be so understaffed. But not all union members are on board with Buick's opinions. Bree Stegall is a union member and has been a social worker in the district for 10 years. She heard about the protest and demand for resignations through rumors. She said, I was really upset because we are union members and have not heard anything. Typically, if there is an issue the union board feels needs addressed, it will send out a mass email with information about holding a meeting. She said instead of union members finding out through random channels and being misrepresented with their voice. In an interview with a reporter Wednesday, Buick said the union as a whole was demanding the resignation of the two administrators. Siegel said Thursday that was not true. She said, they're not representing us. Her opinions about the current administration are the complete opposite of Buick's. Stegall said she would not have stayed in the district for 10 years if she did not love her job, and said the current administration is one reason things are going so smoothly. The accusations about a hostile work environment do not reflect her own experiences with Skinner. Stegall said as principal, Skinner is always visible to staff and often walks the hallways, checking in on students and employees. She said she's able to just jump right in. She's not just sitting in the office. She's part of the school community. Buick has accused the opposite, claiming both Schrader and Skinner are responsible for causing people to quit, saying the district is 15 paraprofessionals short already. There are about 182 people on staff in the district, Buick said, but nearly 100 have left in the last 2 years. Stegall vouched for the high turnover rate, but felt it stemmed from the low pay paraeducators receive. She also said due to Black Hawk being a unique setting, some paraeducators don't realize they are not the right fit for the job until they are on the job. Despite the claims against them, Schrader and Skinner have not faced any consequences related to the union's demands so far, nor have they indicated any intention to resign. Buick said he submitted evidence of these complaints to the governing board on Monday, but the board took no disciplinary action at the monthly meeting on Tuesday. The board plans to discuss these matters at the next meeting on Tuesday, January 16th, board member Gary Rowe said. Buick and others staged a picket, calling for Schrader and Skinner's resignation outside of the administration building Tuesday afternoon. While he did not speak during public comment at the meeting, Buick said he later told a board member they needed to take action, otherwise, quote, we're going to keep protesting. Our students deserve way better than having these two run the district, he said. If necessary, Buick said protests will resume on January 2nd, once school is back in session, but he may not have the support of his union. Stegall is part of a social-emotional learning group through the Regional Office of Education in Illinois, where a survey was filled out by 100 staff members. The overwhelming majority of staff said the culture in every department was positive, and people were happy with where they worked, who they worked for, and how the students were treated, she said. She said, I'm not sure where this is coming from, meaning the accusations. It just seemed to come up this year. I have no idea why. It wasn't an issue before. Emails sent to the governing board were acknowledged Wednesday. Board President Amber Sensenbaugh said in an email to the Quad City Times on Wednesday, we are aware of the complaints raised by the president of the staff union. We value our partnership with the union to serve the students of the community and will continue to work proactively with union leadership to address those concerns. All matters involving employees, however, are confidential per the requirements of Illinois law. Therefore, we will not be commenting further at this time. Schrader echoed similar sentiments, offering no additional statements at this time.
Thanks, Rachel. Quad City Airport celebrates first flights to Charlotte. This written by Gretchen Teske of the Quad City Times. And there's an editor's note. This story was meant to run on A3 of Thursday's edition, and the text of a prior story previewing the new flight mistakenly ran instead. So here goes. Gate A4 at the Quad Cities International Airport was a little busier than normal on Wednesday. The inaugural flight from Moline to Charlotte, North Carolina, took off with a plane full of passengers looking forward to a new route. Airport CEO Ben Leishner said Wednesday afternoon the flight to Charlotte was years in the making. He joined the staff in 2018 and talks about adding a Charlotte flight were already ongoing. Airlines and airports all watch the data to see where passengers are going and where they want to go. This was one that made a lot of sense to American Airlines, and that was one of the first comments I heard, he said. I was really optimistic we would start seeing service in early 2020, but we all know what happened at that time, so this has been long in the works. Flights to Charlotte will leave the airport twice a day, once in the morning and again at night. An airport spokesperson said Tuesday the flights through the new year were 85% full, a good sign of things to come. Charlotte Douglas International Airport came in as the world's 19th busiest airport in 2022, with almost 45 million passengers, according to Airports Council International. In an average day, it sees 114,000 arrivals and departures, according to the airport's website. The last time the Quad Cities added a flight was 2015, with a daily service to Washington, D.C. The Quad Cities International Airport already connects to Chicago and Atlanta, but adding another hub to the resume helps expand the map for local travelers. Leishner said, Wednesday, Charlotte offers service to the 178 cities, including in Florida, the Caribbean, and Mexico. Whether you're traveling for business, leisure, or a little bit of both, you can now get where you're going quicker and easier. Resource constraints are still posing a major challenge as airlines strive to meet historic travel demands. We appreciate the American Airlines team for seeing the value and opportunity in starting this service. When it was first announced in July, officials said the new flight would be beneficial to the business community. Visit Quad Cities CEO Dave Harrell said it will impact tourism as well. The more connectivity we have to the world is a positive thing, he said. More flights is only going to add value to our regional destination, but it's up to us, Quad Cityans, to drive up demand.
Registration now open for the 50th Quad City Times BIC 7, this by Gretchen Teske. Registration is open for the 50th annual Quad City Times BIC 7, which is planned for July 27, 2024. The race weekend festivities include the 7-mile race, Prairie Farms Quick BIC 2-mile, Arconic Junior BIC for children ages 12 and under, and Genesis Sports Medicine Brady Street Sprints. Those interested in participating in this milestone edition of the event can register online at bix7.com. People are contacting us every day to ask when registration for 2024 will open. It's clear from the enthusiasm that we're seeing, with months still to go till race weekend, our 50th is kind of a big deal, Race Director Michelle Uring said in a press release. As we continue to plan all the special details for this golden year, we're thrilled to give folks the golden ticket to sign up now. Registering early guarantees the lowest entry fee. Participants will receive a commemorative 50th Annual Finisher's Medal, race shirt, poster opportunity for a personalized bib, anniversary pins, live music along the course, and the biggest Walmart post-race party. The 7-mile race will be the main event. The historic out-and-back race through downtown Davenport starts at the base of Brady Street, with runners passing live bands and cheering crowds. Recreational runners and walkers can participate right alongside top athletes. The 7-mile race will be one of 8 national championships for the Roadrunners Club of America in 2024 and is part of the professional road running organization circuit, bringing in competitive fields of elite runners. Participants of all levels can compete for prize money and awards in the Caesars Sportsbook Team Challenge, Premier Buick GMC Dealers High School Challenge, and First Responders Challenge. Russell's Beat the Elite and the Scott County Regional Authority's All City Challenge. In the weeks ahead of the race, participants can train with hundreds of other runners at the Iowa American Water Bix at 6 training runs. These group runs begin at 6 p.m. on Thursdays, kicking off in mid-June. The 50th annual Quad City Times Bix 7 will continue its tradition of giving back to the community. The charity partner for the 2024 is Genesis Outpatient Pediatric Therapy. Dollars raised will help that organization's therapists to provide physical, speech, and occupational therapy for children in the Quad Cities.
Thanks, Rachel. A couple articles here regarding mistreatment of children. A man charged with abuse of a child. This written by Thomas Geyer of the Quad City Times. A Davenport man has been charged with allegedly abusing a child multiple times over the course of the past 18 months, Davenport police said. Kenard Watkins Jr., 30, is charged in Scott County District Court with 3 counts of second-degree sexual abuse and 1 count of continuous sexual abuse of a child. Each of the charges is a Class B felony under Iowa law that carry a prison sentence of 25 years. Watkins also is charged with 1 count of child endangerment and an aggravated misdemeanor that carries a prison sentence of 2 years. According to the arrest affidavit filed by Davenport Police Detective Evan Obert, Davenport police were called around 2:30 p.m. November 30th to investigate a report of sexual assault. The sexual abuse occurred at least 3 times since June of 2022, with the most recent assault occurring a couple of days prior to the disclosure. The victim told police that Watkins would force her to drink alcohol before some of the acts. During a first appearance on the charges Thursday in Scott County District Court, Magistrate Richard Wells scheduled a preliminary hearing in the case for December 29th, and Watkins was being held Thursday night in the Scott County Jail on a $100,000 cash-only bond. And then a man accused of fleeing police with children in vehicle. This written by Anthony Watt, writer for the Quad City Times. A Davenport man faces charges after authorities accused him of fleeing a traffic stop with children in the SUV he was driving. There are a number of charges and citations filed against Aaron T. Hayes, 33, in relation to the incident, according to Scott County court records. They include felony, eluding, and several misdemeanor counts of child endangerment. The alleged criminal acts underlying the charges began during a traffic stop around 10 p.m. on December 3rd in the area of River Drive and Mississippi Avenue, according to court records. An Iowa State Patrol trooper stopped a 2007 Chevrolet Suburban for traveling 54 mile an hour in a 40 mile an hour zone in the 1600 block of East River Drive. The area was also a marked construction zone. The driver stopped initially and a passenger got out of the Suburban, but as the trooper approached, the driver sped away, records state. The records did not provide further detail about the passenger who left the Suburban. During the ensuing pursuit through Southeast Davenport, the driver, allegedly Hayes, ignored traffic signals. At one point, the SUV reached a speed of 61 mile an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone. The vehicle chase ended when the driver entered a dead end, but he then ran away, court records state. The trooper continued pursuing him, but lost sight of the driver. Authorities then searched, including with a police dog, but did not find the driver. Another trooper involved in the incident found a woman and five children in the SUV, records state. The children ranged in age from 2 years to 10 years of age. Court records did not provide further detail about the children. During the investigation, the troopers identified Hayes as a suspected driver, records state. He has ties to the Suburban's registered owner, and witnesses saw him driving the vehicle earlier that night. Hayes also matched the description of the person who ran away from the Suburban, according to court records. Hayes has a revoked license until October 2025, records state. The Scott County courts issued a warrant for Hayes' arrest on Wednesday, and the Scott County Sheriff's Office served the warrant Wednesday afternoon, records state. Hayes made his first appearance on the charges on Thursday morning, records show, and his next appearance has been set for December 29th. He was free Thursday afternoon after posting a $5,000 bond.
And to end this first half hour, Haley campaigns on her electability and foreign policy. This by Sarah Watson of the Times. Nearly everyone in a Davenport Von Maur warehouse raised their hand when GOP hopeful Nikki Haley asked who was hearing her at a town hall for the first time. "Where have you all been?" she joked. Haley's Wednesday visit to the Davenport-based clothing company's headquarters came less than a month before the January 15th Iowa caucuses. The most recent polling in the state shows Haley battling with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for second behind former President Donald Trump. All of them have ramped up visits to Iowa as the caucuses draw nearer. For George Shank, age 59, of Long Grove, Wednesday's stop sealed his support for Haley. He'd previously seen DeSantis in Eldridge. He said, "I can't get over the sense of calm, the experience that she brings. This is someone Democrats and independents can vote for," Shank said. "I don't think there's anyone else on the Republican side that others can put their hands up for." Holding a Haley sign, he said he liked her sensibility about how she approaches topics, how she approaches answers. Haley spent the bulk of her stump speech on her foreign policy, highlighting her experience at the United Nations, urging U.S. support for Ukraine and Israel, and more aggressively deporting immigrants who cross the border illegally. Haley recently has included barbs aimed at DeSantis and Trump at the end of her speech, which she reiterated Wednesday. Haley said ads DeSantis and Trump have aired about her include falsehoods. She was critical of DeSantis campaigning with Kentucky Republican Congressman Thomas Massie, who she called, quote, "about the most anti-Israel congressman there," end quote, for his votes against condemning anti-Semitism on college campuses. DeSantis, answering a question about Massie campaigning for him in a Bettendorf stop on Monday, said he disagrees with Massie's stances on Israel and isolationism, but that my 80% friend is not my 20% enemy, and we've got to stop thinking that way as Republicans. DeSantis called himself, quote, "the most pro-Israel member of Congress when we served together," end quote, and said he appreciated the Kentucky representative's stances on the pandemic. Haley pointed to a recent Wall Street Journal poll that showed her up by 17 points against President Joe Biden in a general election and showed her in second in early state primaries. "We've just got one more fella to catch up to, and we're on our way," Haley said to applause. Christmas is a busy time for Von Maur, and the clothing racks and boxes filled the warehouse around the setup for Haley's campaign visit. Jim and Melissa Von Maur hosted the event. Jim Von Maur told the audience 90% of Von Maur's employees are women. "We're very proud of that. We understand what women can do," he said. They've helped us create the best store in America, and Iowa's voters are beginning to understand that too. Jim noted Iowa has elected its first female governor and U.S. senator and representatives in the past 10 years. "So maybe it's time we send a woman to the White House to clean up the mess in Washington, D.C., he said to applause. After the event, Melissa von Maurer said Haley resonated with her as a mom of three kids. She said she also appreciated how Haley spoke about abortion with empathy as a deeply personal issue. In a response to a question from an attendee about her stance on abortion, Haley said she personally is anti-abortion because her husband is adopted, but says she doesn't judge someone for believing that a woman should have a right to an abortion either. She said she supported the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade and send the decision back to the states. She said she would push for consensus on abortion. She said, can't we say, let's ban late-term abortions? Can't we say, let's encourage adoptions and good quality adoptions? Can't we say that no doctor or nurse that doesn't believe in abortion should have to perform one? Can't we say that contraception should be accessible? And can't we say that no state law should say to a woman who's had an abortion that she's going to jail or getting the death penalty? Let's start there. Let's humanize this issue. Haley said her college roommate was raped and said she, quote, wouldn't wish on anybody to go through what she went through, wondering if she was pregnant. Our overall goal should be how do we save as many babies as we can and support as many moms as we can. It's 11:31, time to turn to the obituaries in today's Quad City Times. There are two obituaries and a number of pending death notices. I'll start with the death notices, and then, Jim, if you'll read the two obituaries. Randy Bowers, age 70, of Davenport, passed away on Tuesday, December 19th. Thomas Johnston, age 75, of Moline, passed away November 23rd at Unity Point Health, Trinity Rock Island. Clara Ann Jenkins, age 88, of Indianapolis, Indiana, formerly of Rock Island, passed away Monday, December 18th in Indianapolis. J. Hunt Harris, age 74, of Naperville, Illinois, formerly of Moline, passed away Wednesday, December 20th in Naperville. C. Stanley Uskovich, age 93, of South Pasadena, Florida, formerly of East Moline, Illinois, passed away Thursday, December 21st, in St. Petersburg, Florida. Harold G. Larson, age 94, of Orion, Illinois, passed away December 19th in Milan. And Bonnie J. Thompson, age 88, of Rock Island, Illinois, passed away on Thursday, December 21st at Unity Point Trinity Hospital in Rock Island.
And we have Eugene Welty. Eugene Welty passed away peacefully at Clarissa Cook Hospice on December 20th, 2023. Gene was 98 years young. He was quiet and humble and had a wicked dry sense of humor. He lived a long, full, and adventurous life as a son, a brother, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and a friend. He was a dedicated family man and was married to the love of his life, Ramona, for 71 years. Together they raised two children, Susan and David. Gene was also the proud grandpapa of Spencer and Shelby. Gene will be remembered by many friends and family members as an avid outdoorsman, enjoying hunting, fishing, and boating. He spent many summers traveling with his family on camping adventures, traveling to many states in Canada. Some of his favorite simple pleasures were perfecting his master grilling techniques and being a connoisseur of all kinds of ice cream. He couldn't pass up an ice cream shop, always under the guise of treating the kids. He was also a skilled woodworker, making fine furniture and an inventor of gadgets to make everyday tasks easier. Gene started his life in Richmond, Iowa, and moved to Davenport shortly prior to getting married to Ramona. He has resided here ever since. He proudly served his country as a first lieutenant in the Army Air Corps, flying the B-25 Mitchell during World War II. He worked at Bendix Corporation his entire adult life, retiring twice after being asked to come back following his first retirement. Gene's life, his values, integrity, and dedication to family will live on as an inspiration to all who know him. We can't say enough about the loving care that Gene received at Carissa Cook. We will be forever grateful to the dedicated and caring staff. Funeral services and mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, December 28th at Holy Family Catholic Church. The family will greet friends from 10 o'clock a.m. until the time of the service, and burial will be in Rock Island National Cemetery. Memorials can be sent to Holy Family Church or a preferred charity. And then we have Paul Hammond, 91, of Goose Lake, and he passed away on December 18th at Clarissa Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Memorial services will be 10 o'clock Friday, December 29th, at Zion Lutheran Church in Clinton. Burial will be in the Rock Island National Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday evening at the Clinton Chapel Snell Zonig Funeral Homes and Crematory. And following visitation, his body will be cremated. Online condolences may be expressed by visiting his obituary at www.snellzornig.com. Paul Elliott Hammond was born November 1st, 1930, in Marinsburg, Wyoming. Martinsburg, West Virginia, the son of Paul and Amelia Elliott Hammond. His mother passed away not long after his birth, and he was raised by Harry and Carmen Calvert Hammond. He was a 1948 graduate of Martinsburg High School and earned his bachelor's degree in engineering from West Virginia University in 1952. He joined the United States Army and served from 1953 to 1955. Paul married Lorene Espy on August 11th, 1956, in La Crosse, Wisconsin. She preceded him in death on December 23rd, 2014. Paul worked for Train Company in La Crosse when he met Lorene. He then worked for American Air Filter in Moline for 24 years and retired from McKay International in Minneapolis in 1996. He and Lorene moved to Clinton after his retirement, where they enjoyed travel to visit family and friends, especially to Florida and Louisiana, and many trips to Minnesota and Wisconsin. He was an active member of Zion Lutheran Church. Paul was devoted to his family and friends and deeply loved each one. He was kind and witty and the epitome of a self-disciplined, self-sacrificing man. More than anything, he was a Christian and lived out his life to honor and glorify God in living a life of service to him. He is survived by his three daughters, Susan, spouse Kevin Dunn of Luling, Louisiana, Linda, spouse Mike Gordon of Goose Lake, Iowa, and Joanne Hammond of Hudson, Florida. Six grandchildren, 21 great-grandchildren. Paul was preceded in death by his parents, two brothers, Conrad and Edward Hammond, and sister and brother-in-law, Mary Jo and Wilson Orr, brother-in-law, Bruce Ayler, brother-in-law and sisters-in-law, Norman and Mary Espy, and one grandson-in-law, Caleb Bergeron, the Clarissa Cook Hospice House, for their exceptional care and support in his final days. Memorials may be made to Clarissa Cook Hospice House, St. Jude's Christian Hospital, or the Alzheimer's Association.
Now we turn to the opinion page for the Quad City Times. First opinion piece is Patriotic Parallels Between Churchill and Zelensky. This is written by Mark Schweibert. He's a lawyer and a former mayor of Rock Island. In the modern history of Western civilization, few leaders have struck a stronger chord for the defense of democracy than Winston Churchill. Though his concern with preserving the British Empire was rendered obsolete by a changing world, his sturdy defense of democratic institutions in the face of a rising Nazi threat inspired the British people then, as his words still inspire us today. Rallying his people after first becoming prime minister and as the Nazi menace grew, he declared, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat." After military setbacks, he pledged to defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender. And he promised that 1,000 years from now, men will still say this was their finest hour. Working with American President Franklin Roosevelt, who well understood the Nazi threat affected not only Europe, but our own country as well, the two statesmen forged the Atlantic Charter. This pledged U.S. support for England in their fight against the Nazis and committed efforts to reinforce democracy after the war was over. FDR, faced with isolationist sentiment in this country and America Firsters who saw no threat from Nazi Germany, devised creative ways like the Lend-Lease program to give England a lifeline needed to fight Nazism. He resolved to make our country the arsenal of democracy, and we were. Of course, isolationist attitudes changed overnight after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The America Firsters and isolationists, proven to be demonstrably wrong in their attitude, suddenly realized global threats don't stop at national boundaries, but can and do come to our shores. How strange it is, then, that some of the very people who would be first to celebrate Winston Churchill as a champion of democracy cannot see the parallel with Volodymyr Zelensky in fighting the Russian bully in Ukraine. A modern-day Churchill, Zelensky has courageously rallied his nation against the seemingly insurmountable odds of the vast Russian military. Like Churchill, he did not flinch, but summoned the Ukrainian people to fight in the fields and in the streets of Ukraine. And they've done so at considerable sacrifice in lives, suffering, and national treasure. Like Churchill, Zelensky has been aided in his nation's heroic struggle against foreign tyranny by our current American President Joe Biden. President Biden has done a masterful job of rallying NATO allies to offer a unified defense against Russian aggression. Yet now some modern-day American firsters, using the same refrain of isolationists in the early 1940s, seek to cut U.S. support for Zelensky and Ukraine. They imagine the Russian threat, or that of other possible aggressors like China, Iran, and North Korea, somehow doesn't affect us. In this, they get encouragement from Donald Trump, who was shockingly called Putin's vicious and unprovoked attack on Ukraine an act of genius. It's tragic that some members of Congress seemingly support this reckless attitude and favor undercutting our support of Ukraine and of democracy itself. These folks, instead of keeping America great, are working to make America second rate by selling out our core values and our allies. A far wiser approach sees Zelensky and the Ukrainian people of today as patriotic parallels to Churchill and the English in World War II. We cannot and should not turn a blind eye or deaf ear to bully nations wherever they appear. We do so at our own peril. As Churchill's greatest ally, Franklin Roosevelt, observed in a fireside chat in early 1945, nearing the end of World War II, quote, "We have learned that we cannot live alone at peace, that our well-being is dependent on the well-being of other nations far away. We have learned that we must be a man and not an ostrich. We have learned to be citizens of the world, members of the human community. End quote. May we today be humans and not ostriches, as we extend the same support to Zelensky and his brave fellow Ukrainians as we did to Churchill and the British defenders of democracy 80 years ago. In this, we discourage global bullies and make the world a safer and better place, both for America and all our democratic allies.
Thanks, Rachel. And our second opinion here is written by Cal Thomas. And Cal Thomas is a political columnist syndicated by Tribune Content Agency. And Mr. Thomas writes, "Ignorance and apathy playing out across America." The joke is told about a poll taker who asked about ignorance and apathy in the country. "I don't know and I don't care," says the respondent. The consequence of that attitude are playing out across America. There are two questions most reporters never seem to ask when it comes to mass demonstrations like the recent ones over the Israeli-Hamas war. One is whether they are spontaneous or are they organized and subsidized by outside entities. Second, have large financial gifts from foreign entities and left-wing organizations compromised some universities that fear losing money should they speak up in ways that might offend the donors? Failure to ask these questions contributes to public and student ignorance and apathy. Valerie Richardson of the Washington Times is an exception among journalists today. She writes, "The same U.S. universities that increasingly are seen as breeding grounds for anti-Semitism have taken billions of dollars in previously undisclosed donations from the Middle East. The connection between donations and influence is claimed in a lawsuit by the Lawfare Project on behalf of Carnegie Mellon University student Yale Kanaan. She says she has been the target of pervasive anti-Jewish discrimination. Kanaan linked her allegations to the $500 million donated to the university by Qatar since 2021. Richardson writes about a report by the Network Contagion Research Institute, which showed that universities reported more than $13 billion in gifts from foreign sources between 2014 and 2019. Kenneth Marcus, president of the Brandeis Center, told the newspaper, "What they want is influence. Shouldn't that be obvious?" During her recent controversial testimony before a congressional committee, Harvard president Claudine Gay claimed that the school has strict policies on which gifts and contracts it accepts, and that donors do not influence its policies. Is she saying that anti-Semitism is homegrown? If so, what does that say about the biases of the professors who are transmitting ignorance and what some might consider propaganda to their students? China has infiltrated American universities by making large donations that support Confucius Institutes, which promote Chinese language and cultural programs. In 2019, there were 100 such institutes. Today, there are reportedly fewer than 5. Schools commonly cited the potential loss of federal funding and external pressures as contributing to their decision to close their institutes. However, some critics say the institutes that remain are being used as a part of a larger effort to advance the interests of the Chinese Communist Party, which includes spying and the theft of intellectual property, stealing U.S. military secrets, and harassment of Chinese students and others who are critical of the Beijing regime. 3 years ago, a Jewish organization conducted a first-ever survey in all 50 states to discover what adults under 40 know about the Holocaust. The survey, conducted by the Conference of Jewish Material Claims Against Germany, found 63% did not know that 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust, and over half of these thought the death toll was fewer than 2 million. While more than 40,000 death camps and ghettos were established during World War II, nearly half of U.S. respondents could not name a single one. 1 in 10 respondents did not recall ever having heard the word Holocaust before. Deliberate in ignorance and false teaching about events here and in the Middle East and China, along with the refusal of American media to pay serious attention to the connection between foreign donations and university policies and teaching, plays into the hands of those who do not wish America well. Clearly, the history departments at many schools need a serious upgrade, and a lot of reporters could use a crash course in history at a university that refuses donations from foreign entities that have agendas.
And we have a few minutes to turn to sports. What to watch and what to listen to. What to watch: the Iowa Hawkeyes coming up December 29th versus Northern Illinois at 6 o'clock. Illinois fighting Illini versus Missouri in St. Louis today at 8. Iowa State Cyclones on December 29th at Memphis. Chicago Bulls play Saturday at 7 against the Cavaliers. Chicago Blackhawks versus the Canadiens today at 7:30. Chicago Bears Sunday versus the Cardinals at 3:25 p.m. Green Bay Packers at the Panthers are also Sunday at noon. And the Quad City Storm today at Birmingham at 7:05. And then a number of things on the air of college men's basketball, the most local being likely Illinois versus Missouri on FS1. Women's basketball, Bowling Green at Indiana on BTN. NBA, Denver at Brooklyn at 6:30. And at 9, Washington at Golden State on ESPN. Hockey at 7:30 on ESPN Plus, Montreal at Chicago. So those are some of the things coming up. And this story, Quad City College men's basketball. Illinois College 82, Augustana 78 in an overtime. Augie upset bid falls short. By Tom Johnston. Hollywood would have come up with a much different ending to Thursday's game for the Augustana College men's basketball team. The script was being written for the underdog Vikings during an incredibly difficult week with a coaching change to pull off a huge upset. Instead, reality struck. No ending fit for a movie screen in this one. The Vikings watched a 22-point second-half lead disappear as they ended up saddled with an 82-78 overtime loss to number 23-ranked Illinois College at the Carver Center. It was a game in which the Vikings scored the first 10 points and never trailed in regulation, with Jordan Delp making the calls after head coach Tom Jesse stepped away from the program to take a, quote, voluntary personal leave of absence, end quote. Delp said, "I am just so proud of the way they stayed together and kept coming. That's been a tenet of our program as long as I've been around and will continue to be. They've shown a tremendous amount of resiliency around a very tough situation." Early on, it was tough to tell that there had been any turmoil in the program at all this week. The Vikings put the 11-0 Blue Boys in a hole right from the start while playing with a tremendous amount of energy, taking a 10-0 lead in the opening 4 minutes. With Delp, a former Augie All-Conference player, taking a defensive stance at the end of the Augie bench for much of the game, the Vikings raced to a 43-27 halftime lead and had the nationally ranked IC squad searching for answers. "We've had some tough losses like this before," said Augie senior Tyler Knuth, who led the Vikings with 20 points with the help of 6 of 10 shooting from three-point range. "This is just something we have to keep working on and not let it get to us." Knuth hit two three-pointers right out of intermission that gave the 3-9 Vikings a 49-27 lead with 19 minutes 57 seconds left in regulation. But things started slipping away in the second half as the Vikings got a little passive as the guests figured out a way to attack the Vikings zone and then get to the free throw line as Augie fouls mounted. Illinois College finished 16 of 26 from the line, outscoring Augie by 2 from the stripe. The Blue Boys pulled to within 63-62 with 3 minutes and 22 seconds left in regulation before Chase Larson's 4-point play stretched the Augie lead to 67-62 with 2:55 left. The Vikings still held a 68-65 lead when Buzz Ritzel converted a 3-point play with 56.9 left to tie the contest. The Vikings turned the ball over on their next possession, and the Blue Boys ran down the clock but missed a potential game winner at the buzzer. In the overtime, Illinois College took its first lead when Jake Mazrimas, 14 points, 15 rebounds, scored on an acrobatic putback at the 3:43 mark. Augie answered when Larson hit a bucket at the 3:19 mark. Illinois' Ritzel, who had 19 of his game-high 27 points in the final 25 minutes, then converted another 3-point play and followed with a bucket, and Josh Harris added a field goal that gave the guests a 77-70 lead that they never lost. "That's unreal," said Illinois coach Steve Schwier of his team never leading in regulation and still coming out with a win. "I've been coaching a long time, year 17 for me as an assistant and head coach, and I can't recall a whole bunch of games that a team that I've been coaching has been not dominated the way they were in the first half and been able to come back and win a game. That's a credit to our guys."